from Miller McCune. Welcome to Curiouser and Curiouser. I'm Dr. Jai Ranganathan, and this is podcast number 20. I'm recording this about a week after the terrible 9.0 earthquake in Japan. Normally on the podcast, I interview scientists about their research, but for the next few podcasts, it's going to be a little different. We'll be talking about what's going on with the disaster in Japan, the science behind it anyway. And between the earthquake, tsunami, and nuclear reactor crisis, there is a lot of science to talk about. Let's get going this time with what started it all, the earthquake. So what happened?
This region actually, seismologically, is very active.
Oh, that's Dr. Chen Ji, an earthquake researcher at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Let's start that again.
This region actually, seismologically, is very active. Historically, if you check in the past, every 40 years, there are earthquakes larger than 7 happens. That's a lot, right? So local people know they expect earthquake to happen, but they never expect this big to happen. Okay, this is different.
So why is Japan so cursed by earthquakes? To know that, we need to talk a little about what causes earthquakes in the first place. And to know that, we need to take a trip to a restaurant nearby. Come on, it's lunchtime. Busy lunchtime crowd here. It turns out that the earth has a lot in common with the food they're serving here, particularly the apples. I have an apple here, and I'm just going to cut it in half, like so. Now, if you imagine the earth in cross-section, it's sort of like this half apple. Everything you know is solid ground. Mountains, deserts, whole continents, everything. Heck, let's even throw in the seafloor. All of it is this really thin, thin layer, a thin crust on the surface of the earth. It's so thin that if the earth was the size of this apple here, you would see that the crust of the planet is thinner than the skin of this apple. But here's where the earth and this apple go separate ways. The skin of an apple is one continuous piece, well, until I take a bite. But the crust of the earth is broken up into lots of separate pieces, pieces that are called plates. There are about 7 or 8 major plates and a whole bunch of smaller ones. The crazy thing, though, is these plates are the exact opposite of rock solid. All of them, including the ground underneath you right now, are floating just like cubes of ice in a glass of water. Just like that. But these plates aren't floating in water. Instead, the plates are floating on this thick, super hot layer of semi-melted rock. And not just floating, the plates are being pushed around. What's capable of moving something as big as a floating continent? Well, to answer that, let's take another trip. Descending into the earth this time. Down, down, down. 3,000 kilometers to the core of the earth. It is hot here. 5,000 degrees Celsius, maybe more. This heat mostly is coming from the breakdown of radioactive elements here, like thorium, uranium, that kind of thing. And some of this heat is very old. It's been here, some of it anyway, since when the Earth was formed, 4.5 billion years ago. But this heat is continuously leaping out of the Earth and into space. And that's what's moving these plates and continents around. This continual movement of heat from the center of the Earth out to the surface. I should say, the details of how heat loss translates into plate movement is something that scientists are still trying to work out. But at any rate, let's get out of here too. Back up to the surface. Going up. Back up topside. So all of these plates are getting pushed around. And here's the key thing. All of these plates are getting pushed in different directions. Take, for example, Japan. It's sitting right on the eastern edge of one plate. And just to the east of that is the massive Pacific Plate. It's a giant, giant slab of ocean floor that's sitting under most of the Pacific Ocean. The Pacific Plate is being pushed west, right into the plate where Japan is sitting, colliding right into it. Here's the thing though, remember that all of these plates are just floating. So what happens when one floating thing runs into another floating thing? Well, let's do a little experiment. I've got a coin here, which I'm going to drop into a mug of water. Just like that. And no surprises here. The coin has sunk to the bottom of the mug. And why? Because the metal coin is denser than the water. The same kind of thing happens with these two plates colliding. The denser one sinks. It turns out that the Pacific Plate is a lot denser than the plate where Japan is sitting. So when the Pacific Plate rams into Japan, it gets shoved down under Japan. It kind of looks like an escalator going down. And the Pacific Plate is running into the plate with Japan at a rate of 3 to 4 inches a year. That's a little slower than your hair grows. You certainly don't notice your hair growing, day to day anyway. And you wouldn't normally notice anything else moving that slowly. But here's where Japan gets into real trouble. These plates that are running into each other are basically giant rocks trying to slide past each other. It's not like a hockey puck sliding smoothly across an ice rink. Pretty much the opposite, actually. These plates lock up, get stuck to each other, and stop sliding past each other. That's not a big deal for 1 year. After all, they're only trying to move 3 or 4 inches. But 1 year becomes a century, becomes a millennia, and the pressure builds and builds and builds. Finally, on one fine day, whatever rocks are causing the lockup finally break. And the two plates move past each other in a big rush, making up for all that lost time and causing a lot of shaking topside. So that's your basic earthquake, and that's what happened in Japan generally. Let's talk specifics. On Wednesday, March 9th, 2 days before the main event, there was a 7.2 magnitude earthquake on the plate boundary, just east of Japan under the Pacific Ocean. Not the main thing, but still a very big earthquake. The kind of earthquake that this part of Japan gets every few decades. Not so bad, right? This time though, very bad. Part of the Pacific Plate came unstuck and suddenly shifted under Japan. The part of the plate that had moved put even more strain on the much larger part of the Pacific Plate that was still really, really stuck. And 2 days later, Friday, March 11th, at 2:46 in the afternoon, the strain was too much. 45 miles east of the Japanese coast, a huge stretch of the Pacific Plate, maybe 300 miles long, broke free and surged westward under Japan. As much as 120 feet of movement all at once. At the same time, the plate Japan was sitting on moved east about 8 feet. Here's that 9.0 earthquake, the fifth most powerful earthquake ever recorded. And even though it was less than 2 more on the Richter scale than the earthquake that came 2 days earlier, it released about 1,000 times the energy, like 600 million atomic bombs over Hiroshima. The earthquake would have been an epic disaster all by itself. But what came next was even worse, the tsunami. But how did the earthquake cause a tsunami? Here's the connection. At the plate boundary during the earthquake, the Pacific Plate surged down under Japan. Meanwhile, the plate with Japan on it got pushed up by almost 30 feet. And remember that the epicenter of the earthquake was offshore under the Pacific Ocean. All that water on top of the epicenter has suddenly been pushed up 30 feet, and that water wants to rush back down in a big hurry. That's how the tsunami starts, and the wave gets going with a bang. Moving at 500 miles an hour, the speed of a jet, the wave spreads across the Pacific. In 10 minutes, that wave begins to hit Japan, and then things get much worse. It turns out that the speed of the wave depends on how deep the ocean is. The shallower the ocean, the slower the wave. So as the front edge of the wave nears the Japanese coastline, the ocean gets shallower and the front of the wave slows down. Here's the problem. All of the water behind the front edge is still going at jet speeds and starts piling into that front edge, a traffic jam of water that causes the wave to build and build and build. In some places, when that wave hit land, it was as tall as a three-story building. With that kind of power, it's not surprising that whole villages on the coast were erased. So what now? Unfortunately, more big earthquakes might be coming for Japan, and the big worry is Tokyo. Tokyo is pretty much sitting right on top of a triple junction where three plates come together. And in 1923, there was a magnitude 8 earthquake under Tokyo, and it killed 142,000 people. Since then, this plate boundary has been relatively quiet. There were some aftershocks after this last big one. But here's the worry. The magnitude 7 earthquake set the stage 2 days later for the magnitude 9 earthquake by increasing the strain at a plate boundary. Well, the same thing might have just occurred again. This giant earthquake might have just increased the strain on the plates under Tokyo. And that's where we are. And thank you for listening to the podcast. I'd like to thank Dr. Chen Ji, the seismologist you heard at the beginning of the podcast, for talking with me and for providing pretty much all the information you heard here. I used a large number of songs and sound effects in this podcast. To find a complete list of audio credits, plus much more, go to Miller McCune Online. That's www.miller-mccune.com.